Welcome to All Movie Talk, a little show we like to call All Movie Talk, and we have, as usual, a great episode for you, which we like to call episode 46, and this is August 14th, 2007. So we'll kick things off with the conclusion of our three-part director spotlight about Alfred Hitchcock. And of course, the end of thrillers are always the best, so probably this will be the best and maybe have a twist ending. I don't know. We'll follow things up with a trivia question and then jump into our top six list for this week, which is about plot holes in good movies. Usually you think of a plot hole as a flaw, but we're going to find some in good and sometimes even great movies. And to end our show, we'll have the first of a two-part segment about the history of editing. We've talked a lot about editing terms and film buff dictionaries dating way back, but now we're going to recap it all together into a more comprehensive history of movie editing. I am Sam Stoddard.
And I am not Jason Bourne. I am, in fact, Stephen Keller. Sorry about that. I'm still pumped up on how much I love that Bourne series, huh?
Yeah. So you really like the Bourne series? What? Wait a minute.
I've been a fan of them since the very beginning.
Okay, wait. Okay, let's break character here. I think we have a problem with the writing on our show here. I think I detect an inconsistency here. I remember, I think it was episode 17, you said you really did not like the Jason Bourne series, so you can't just come out and say you like them now.
Oh, that's right.
It's a continuity error.
Stephen's not supposed to like the Jason Bourne series.
Right.
That's right.
Let's just redo that part. I am Sam Stoddard.
And I am Stephen Keller, who definitely does not like the Bourne movies at all.
Very good. Well, we've talked a lot about Hitchcock the last couple of weeks, and we're going to talk a lot more. Let's kick this off with Strangers on a Train from 1951. Now, when I was younger, I think this was actually my favorite Hitchcock movie, and it's still up there. It's certainly one of his most effective as a suspense thrill ride, white knuckle, grip the edge of your seat, kind of, you know, that all that stuff. The suspense it builds is actually quite amazing, but there's also this psychological edge to it, too, which is, you know, I guess typical for Hitchcock. The setup is pretty famous. These two strangers are talking on a train, and one guy gets the idea, hey, we both have someone in our lives who is causing a lot of trouble. So let's trade murders. You kill my guy, I'll kill yours, and we'll both have alibis, so we'll both get away with it, as we don't have motive to kill each other's father or wife. Well, these two part company, one of them thinking that the deal has been made, and the other one just thinking, well, sheesh, what a lunatic. You know, he doesn't realize that the other guy took it seriously and went away with the mistaken impression that they came to an agreement. Well, things obviously are going to spiral out of control from there, and it puts the one good guy, who's a tennis player, into a corner, and he has to wrestle with, how does he get out of this situation? It's important that he's a tennis player, because one of the great suspense sequences is him playing tennis, and you hear, on the sound editing part, you hear the tennis ball being hit by the racket back and forth, and the crowd's faces going back and forth, and it puts a neat bit of timing in. Anyway, I think this movie does a fantastic job of conveying how trapped this character feels throughout the movie.
Yeah, I love Strangers on a Train as well. I mean, it's just such a cool premise, the sort of thing that Hitchcock would be attracted to, and does a really wonderful job with it.
Yes. And so moving on, we get Dial M for Murder in 1954. This is a real mind game about a guy who plans the perfect murder, but, you know, he knows that perfect plans don't work out in real life because people don't do what you expect them to always, but he attempts it anyway, and obviously, predictably, as he well knows, things go haywire. Now, I like the movie, partly it's this kind of psychological paradox here. He knows it isn't going to work, but he tries anyway. I mean, there's something wrong with him, first of all, but there's something kind of interesting about people trying to do things that they know aren't going to work out. I wouldn't call this one of Hitchcock's best movies. It does seem to be very fondly remembered, though, and it is a good movie. It stars Grace Kelly, too, which is important because Hitchcock would work with her three times in three very noteworthy movies, the next one being the very great Rear Window, which is my personal favorite Hitchcock movie, and I love it for reasons that Stephen kind of explained pretty well in our first segment about Hitchcock, because it's about voyeurism. And, well, first of all, actually, let's just say it is a great entertainment. I mean, it's incredibly suspenseful. But this underlying theme of voyeurism really speaks to why we like to watch movies in the first place. I mean, the setup, I think you may know it already. This guy, played by Jimmy Stewart, has broken his leg, and he's holed up in his apartment with nothing to do. So he spends his time looking out the window and spying on the neighbors in the apartment complex. And at some point, he thinks he witnesses things that suggest that a murder has been committed. Now, except for one moment in the movie, the camera stays within his apartment, so we're looking around at the neighbors from his perspective, and essentially, Hitchcock makes voyeurs out of us, the audience, and the film offers some underlying commentary on that, which, you know, in turn sort of functions as a commentary on why we watch movies in the first place. So, should this guy be getting his nose into his neighbor's business? Well, should you be getting your noses into his business? It's a multi-layered thing, you know, when you consider that this is a metaphor for watching movies, maybe. Because watching people is fascinating to us, but it's sort of hypocritical, too, because we probably wouldn't want to be watched all the time ourselves. We're just fine with observing other people and remaining unobserved. And this movie does definitely have something to say about that. And it's got some food for thought. I mean, think about the attitude that the main character has toward what he sees out the window versus the things going on in his own apartment. And people have noted, if you look at the different stories happening in the other apartments that he's peeping on, there's sort of aspects of his own life kind of mirrored or twisted around a little bit. What goes on in his own apartment isn't all that different from everything going on outside of in the other people's apartments, but he's not that interested in it. In fact, you could make the observation that his interest in the woman in his life really doesn't become, it's elevated to a whole new level at the point that she crosses over and starts being visible in the other people's apartment. It's a very interesting dynamic there, and, you know, fascinating to think about, even though you can also just take it as a work of entertainment. It's nice you can have a movie both ways like that.
Yeah, I think you gave a pretty good analysis of some of the more complex themes in the film, but I'll just say this is my favorite Hitchcock, and I think the climax of the film may be the single most suspenseful scene ever in a movie, period. For me, it certainly is. The first time I saw it, I was just literally gripping the edge of my seat. Just great, great stuff.
Right. And you know what's neat is the suspense moments, the parts that we kind of gasp at, do directly play into the underlying themes as well. I mean, there's this moment where he's looking out the window, but people don't see him. I mean, that kind of division breaks down, and that's sort of what causes the suspense. So it's weird that it's not just, okay, it's an entertainment and a social commentary. It's the two things at the same time, truly a single unit. And before we move on, I also want to comment about a particular shot in the movie that's always stuck in my mind, and that's the entrance of Grace Kelly to the movie. Jimmy Stewart is dozing off, and the way the lighting is set up, it looks like he might be having a dream or a hallucination or a memory or something. And we see him in profile, and all of a sudden Grace Kelly, a character we just do not know yet, moves in from outside the frame and into it and kisses him. And this wonderfully surreal kind of shot. If you can remember in a recent Film Buffs Dictionary segment we did, we talked about how you can get slow motion by over-cranking the camera so that you're filming more frames per second than you're going to project. So when you go to project them at the normal speed, everything slows down. That's one technique, and it gives you a nice, smooth, slow motion. I don't think that's what was used here, because there's another way to do it, and that is, okay, film at normal speed, or maybe even slower than normal speed, and duplicate the frames so that you see every frame twice or three times instead of once. That will also slow things down, but the effect is totally different. It's going to be a little jittery, a little jagged kind of emotion, not smooth at all. And it looks like that's how Grace Kelly's entrance was done here, with this jittery slow motion shot. But it's so perfect. I mean, I can't even explain why it's so effective, but it's such a beautiful, surreal kind of moment. My honest opinion, it's right up there with Orson Welles in The Third Man for great movie entrances. And so the next movie that Hitch made with Grace Kelly would be To Catch a Thief, also with Cary Grant in it as a cat burglar. Kind of a light, frothy kind of caper movie. A lot more fun, a lot less gritty and psychological than Rear Window. And it's also Grace Kelly's last movie, I think, before she retired from acting to become the Princess of Monaco. So let's move right along to The Trouble with Harry. We talked about this before, kind of a dark comedy. But Hitchcock said that his favorite line from all his movies was in The Trouble with Harry, and this is great for illustrating a sense of humor. So basically, okay, this dead body is found in a woods near this quiet New England town, and this character, Captain Wiles, decides he better get him out of the woods, and so he grabs his feet and starts dragging him away. So you got this image of a kindly, gentle old man dragging a dead body through the woods, and this woman is passing by, somebody else who lives in the town, and she says, "What seems to be the trouble, Captain?" Hilarious line, very British. Even though it takes place in New England, this is British. I mean, it's understated, macabre, kind of very Hitchcockian humor. But he returned to the thriller form a bit for The Man Who Knew Too Much in 1956, which is a remake of his 34 movie. We talked about this in our list of great remakes, so I won't repeat those comments here. But really interesting to see a director remaking his own work at a later point in his career to, you know, correct what he thought he had done wrong. Well, speaking of wrong, The Wrong Man is next, and this is very obviously an exercise in Hitchcock's favorite subject, you know, the innocent man wrongfully accused. It's right there in the title. This time, a black and white documentary-like account of an innocent man being mistaken for a criminal. And this stars Henry Fonda, the only time Fonda ever worked with Hitchcock, but pretty effective. Kind of maybe overlooked because the movies he made before and after were so much better, but still a good entry in his filmography. And now I get to Vertigo. Well, some people say that Vertigo is Hitchcock's most personal film. I'm not sure how anybody but Hitchcock can make that call, but I know what they mean, because the movie digs further down, I think, into the human psyche and just deep into the part of the mind that's not even rational. It's just who we are as people. And in fact, it's one of the most psychologically complex movies I know of, period. You have a guy played by Jimmy Stewart who falls in love with a woman, and things go bad in ways I won't get into, but then he meets another woman, and that relationship is just fascinatingly twisted and wrong and tragic, but very compelling. I mean, he falls in love with her mostly because she reminds him of the first woman that he became obsessed with. And so what he does is he tries to remake her into that woman. And, you know, okay, can you wear the clothes that she wore? Can you put your hair this way? And she's not an idiot. She knows he's doing this and why he's doing it. But she's complicit in this kind of dysfunctional thing because she's fallen in love with him and figures, hey, if it takes becoming somebody else, this memory that he has, to keep him, she will do it. And so you have these two characters who mutually agree to this kind of self-destructive it really is. It's a self-destructive relationship. Their obsessions kind of feed off each other. And, you know, as tragic as this is, you just cannot stop watching it. You know, what is going to happen with these two people that are unwittingly doing these terrible things to each other? Well, this had to be a tough movie to do right. I mean, a story like this, you either hit it out of the park or just you completely strike out, because the success of it depends on whether the movie can get you inside the heads of the characters, and I think absolutely 100% yes, this movie does. And yet, I haven't mentioned that this is also a signature thriller. It doesn't sound like it, but, you know, there's intrigue and murder and all that going on, but the real story is of the obsessions of these two characters.
Yeah, man, there's so much to talk about with Vertigo, isn't there? You know, I understand completely when people say this is Hitchcock's most personal film, because it seems to just constantly be the culmination of all of his various obsessions. You know, the icy blonde or blondes, the watching people thing. I mean, the whole first section where Jimmy Stewart's just following this woman around. There's the bit about making people different and changing them. And what's that say about a director who quite literally has done that, you know, dozens of times, made people into other people in terms of making actors and other people, and this idea of changing things and the idea of not being able to get over the past, and it all just folds in on itself so many times, and it's such a twisted, tricky, bizarre movie, but it's so compelling, and it's one of the movies that I think holds up really, really well for repeated viewings, and I've seen it a couple of times, and I just really, really appreciate it more and more every time I see it. I used to just say unequivocally that Rear Window is my favorite Hitchcock movie, but I don't know, these days Vertigo's making a real run for it, because every time I watch Vertigo, I just pick up new things, and I'm so constantly impressed by how complex it is, despite being a really straightforward kind of thriller story on the surface that has some interesting twists. But yeah, Vertigo is so compelling. It's almost like Citizen Kane or something, the amount of stuff you miss the first time until you've gone back and watched it more than once.
You know, what you say about coming around on Rear Window is, I think, what's happening just in general, because Vertigo was not well received in the beginning. It was perceived as a box office failure. And critically, you know, not exactly acclaimed like a lot of other Hitchcock movies were. And recently, within the last 10 years, I think, people have just discovered, wow, okay, this Vertigo thing, this is the one. So a lot of people are calling Vertigo the greatest Hitchcock movie and maybe one of the top 10 movies ever made. Let's skip on to another one of my favorites, although not nearly as psychologically complex. Hitchcock wanted to make a movie that was lighter and frothier and more fun, less bogged down in symbolism, and so he hired Ernest Lehman to write the screenplay for North by Northwest, and when he did, Lehman set out to write the Hitchcock picture to end all Hitchcock pictures. And boy, I mean, he darn near did it. This is probably the best Hitchcock espionage thriller about a guy that this crime organization mistakes for a government agent. And if you know Hitchcock, you should know that soon the cops will wind up chasing the guy too. So there's great set piece after great set piece in this, a murder in the UN, a climax on Mount Rushmore. Actually, there's an interesting note about that. It speaks to Hitchcock's sense of humor. He originally wanted to call this movie The Man in Lincoln's Nose, in reference to the climax on Mount Rushmore. He's going to have Cary Grant hide inside Lincoln's nose, hide from the bad guy, and sneeze and give himself away. But anyway, yeah. And in the middle, there's a sequence where he's drugged and put in a speeding car on the cliffs and everything. I mean, all these great sequences. Probably the best remembered is the crop duster sequence where Cary Grant is stuck out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, there's nowhere to hide, really. It's just a wide open area, and this crop duster plane starts trying to run him down. Very iconic scene and copied a lot of places by other filmmakers. And in a sense, North by Northwest is the father of the modern action movie. I mean, it inspired James Bond, which in turn inspired Indiana Jones, which in turn, you know, so on. Suddenly we get a modern action movie, and North by Northwest is kind of the father of all of those, so a really interesting movie to watch today. And we'll move on to Psycho. Now, we've talked a lot about Psycho before, so we can be brief here, but, you know, third masterpiece in 3 years. Also third great Bernard Herrmann musical score in a row, too. He also scored Vertigo and North by Northwest, and those two, along with Psycho's score, are very iconic. I mean, he should have won 3 Academy Awards in a row, I think. The Psycho music, kind of like the Jaws music, in that it can scare some people just by humming it a little. Great cinematography, too, shot in black and white, actually so the blood wouldn't look quite so gory. Hitchcock knew something that I wish people still knew, and that is that gore really doesn't have anything to do with making something scary or shocking. You can make a pretty shocking movie without it. So let's skip along to The Birds in 1963. Now, we haven't talked about this one, but we're going to in an upcoming Top 6 segment, so again, I'm going to be brief here. But this is a great scary movie with some fantastic shots and use of sound in it. Not a lot of movies like this one, actually. I mean, certainly there are plenty that try to imitate it and fail, but it's the tone that makes this movie. I think the fact that underneath the horror going on, there's this dark sense of humor and kind of a bit of irony. It's a tricky balance to maintain, but an underappreciated classic, I think. And also underappreciated, but even more so, would be Marnie, made the following year. It's hard, though, not to underappreciate it when you look back at the previous decade of Hitchcock movies and how great they were, and then you see Marnie. But this is still a great film, I think. Pretty expressionistic. A lot of Hitchcock movies have expressionistic elements to them. Vertigo, definitely, but, you know, there's pretty strong here. Sean Connery is in this movie. It's the only movie he made with Hitchcock. He had just become James Bond a couple of years earlier, and he wanted to do some other things and wanted to work with Hitchcock, so he did. And speaking of Bond, Hitchcock's next two movies were sort of attempts to make more realistic Bond movies, you know, these espionage action movies that weren't quite so outlandish, and they were Torn Curtain in 1966, which was Hitchcock's 50th movie. Most directors don't get up to 50 these days. And then Topaz in 1969. Torn Curtain was pretty good. Stars Paul Newman and Julie Andrews in a Cold War story about defection and stealing intelligence secrets and so forth. One of those espionage thrillers. Not usually considered great, but certainly a lot of fun. Topaz, not so much. It's weird. In some ways, it doesn't feel like a Hitchcock movie at all. I mean, there really isn't a main character in the movie. It's a bunch of co-stars that each have their piece of the story, and the trouble is we don't really care about any of them. There is, however, one curiosity about the film that's worth looking at as a study of how editing can be quite powerful sometimes. That's the ending. A number of different endings were talked about. Some of them were shot, and none of them worked. Eventually, Hitchcock ran out of money, and so he could not shoot an ending, and he didn't have an ending. So, basically, you know, a lot of head-scratching and thinking and looking at the footage they have. And so an ending was conceived that could be created in the editing room with existing footage. They had this one shot of a guy going into a building somewhere. Wasn't the same guy they needed to get into a building somewhere, but they had this shot and they used it, and they cut it so that you couldn't tell it wasn't the guy they wanted it to be. And the rest is done with sound effects. You just hear what happens after he goes inside, and that's your ending. Pretty remarkable. You have to see it to know what I mean, I guess. But at this point, it's pretty clear that Hitchcock is past his prime. However, he had at least one great movie left in him, and that would be Frenzy from 1972. Uncharacteristically graphic for a Hitchcock movie, but otherwise a real return to form. In some ways, it kind of wraps his career all the way back to The Lodger, as it's about a serial killer loose in London, and Hitchcock wanted to make this movie in part to kind of document the London and the certain areas in London that he remembered as a child growing up. So this is kind of an ode to London, I suppose. But it does return to the theme of the man falsely accused of the crime and how he's on the run. And again, I'm repeating the same plot synopsis for all these different movies, but despite having a common style, they're not derivative of each other at all. Frenzy is great in its own way. There are a few things I love about this movie. One, stone-cold, chilling use of silence. There's these moments where absolutely everything becomes unnaturally quiet, and it's just so effective at heightening your expectation of what's going to happen next. And it kind of clues you in on what's about to happen, too, which doesn't sound like a good thing, but it is. It creates this sense of foreboding before the thing actually happens. And I also love this macabre sense of humor in this, as I've mentioned before. There's a suspense sequence on a truck where this killer has to retrieve some evidence from one of his victims, but it turns out she's buried in this moving potato truck, and so he's flailing around amongst all these potatoes, and it turns out the rigor mortis has set in on the dead body already, and so he has to, well, I won't go into details that the movie can do that, but it's a pretty grisly and morbid sequence, but in this darkly humorous kind of way that tempers the effect a little bit. And I also love a lot of the dialogue, in particular the very last line, which is this really neat, clean way to wrap everything up. A disturbing movie, but a great one. And that was his next to last movie. His last movie was Family Plot in 1976, which was a lot more comedic. It was a comedy caper kind of movie. Pretty minor work, a bit uneven, but fun nevertheless, and with some great moments in it. And that was it. He was preparing another movie after that, but ultimately it became clear that he wasn't going to have the stamina to handle the shooting of it. So it never got made, and he died in 1980. But you know what, Stephen? You know me. I mean, talking about all these movies the past 3 weeks or whatever really makes me want to go back and watch them again. So I think maybe I'll do that. I'll watch them all in chronological order. That could be fun. What do you think?
Yeah, then I think you should do that as soon as you get around to posting your thoughts on the James Bond rewatch.
Yeah, I still have to do that too. It's time for the trivia portion of our show. As always, The question for this week is, what was the first movie, and maybe the only, I'm not sure if there's been any others since, but at least what was the first movie to feature more than one actor who had ever played Batman? We'll come back with the answer at the end of the show.
We all love a well-told and well-constructed story, but even sometimes the best written scripts have some rather gaping plot holes, and the movies tend to play fast and loose with that kind of thing. So I thought we'd take a look today at just sort of a fun, light top six list, and top six good movies that have great plot holes, or maybe the other way around, top six great plot holes and otherwise fine movies. So maybe these won't be the best movies with plot holes. The whole point is to talk about some fun and wacky things that sometimes get overlooked when the film is being made. So for my number six pick, well, not the best movie ever, but one of my favorite plot holes from any flick, and that is from The Rock, the 1996 Michael Bay film, which I actually think is a very fine action movie from Michael Bay, a guy who otherwise I don't like that much. But anyway, it's a silly movie all the way through, but there's this one point in the beginning of the film where Sean Connery plays this secret British special service James Bond type guy who's the only man to ever broken out of Alcatraz, and he's leading this team of guys back into Alcatraz to overtake some hostages. Anyway, they come to this point when they're trying to sneak into Alcatraz, and there's this weird flaming death trap, and they're like, oh, how are we going to get through this? And Connery says, ah, well, when he escaped, he memorized the timing of this thing as it spurts flame or whatever. It seems like something out of a Tomb Raider video game, frankly. He says, I just memorized the timing he can roll through. So, of course, he still has it memorized, and he rolls through it and is fine. And then, from the other side, he opens the door that so the rest of the team can pass through without having to memorize the timing. But this has always raised a really good question, which is, if there's a door on the other side that he can open, now remember, in this part of the movie they're breaking back into Alcatraz, he originally broke out, he can just walk through the door on his way out of Alcatraz, so why the heck did he ever have to memorize the timing in the first place? I mean, how did nobody think of that one? Never understood it. You know, it's a silly movie, but I just love that plot hole so much I had to include it.
I have to wonder, who's operating that thing? I mean, what does it take to maintain a flaming, timed fire hall? But, yeah, I got something similar for my number six, and I had a hard time with this list. I guess I tend to forget plot holes easily or forgive them quickly, but there's a funny one in the movie Die Another Day, the 20th James Bond movie. The pre-credits sequence of Die Another Day has this neat action scene on hovercrafts, because hovercrafts are the only way to get over the landmine separating North and South Korea without, you know, blowing yourself up. So they use hovercrafts and go right over the landmines, and that's a plot point. And so there's a big chase on hovercrafts, and Bond escapes from this North Korean base, and you know, he's chasing the bad guys over the landmines and everything. Finally, a ways down the road, the chase ends, and then a bunch of people from back at the base catch up to Bond in their trucks. How did they get there? I mean, it sounds like a detail, but it's actually quite important, because Bond gets captured, and that drives the whole rest of the movie. He should have been clear. There should have been nobody able to get him at that point.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of that, in especially in action movies, where they'll establish something as being totally impossible, and then the hero will somehow get it, and yet, like, just seconds later, the bad guys have also done it, like, off-camera. That one's always... Yeah, you kind of see that a lot. It makes kind of takes the, you know, the mystery and the magic out of the hero being able to accomplish it if everyone else after him is so readily able to do it. Well, I got another action flick for my number five, and it's one of my favorite all-time action movies, and it's Aliens, 1986 by James Cameron. Not a specific plot hole so much as I've never, ever been at all clear on the central plan here by the bad guy, played by Paul Reiser, Burke from the company, who's trying to send the Marines in to capture aliens. It seems like the company has been well aware for a very long time that there are aliens on this planet, and they want to capture them. So why don't they send in some people to capture them? I mean, their first plan is to send a bunch of colonists there to their death, but they don't appear to have any way to get the aliens back, and they send, like, this ragtag team of, like, 10 or 12 Marines to go fight them. And why does Burke have to go anyway? Why don't they just, like, hire some mercenaries to go capture them? Why send in these Marines unawares that they don't even know they're supposed to be... I'm not clear at any point in time why they have to go through this. And why exactly does he bring Sigourney Weaver with him anyway? Because she's the only one that's fought them before. Look, the company clearly has limitless resources in these movies. I've never, ever, ever understood why the heck they don't just send some people out there explicitly to get back the aliens. Why all the subterfuge, Paul Reiser?
You know, it's funny that there's these plot holes in pretty great movies sometimes, and I've read a lot of reviews of people, not professional reviews, but people on IMDb and things like that, and saying, you know, this movie was terrible because think about this plot hole. And I think really what they're saying is, look how proud I am of having seen this plot hole without having somebody told it to me. I mean, it has nothing to do with it. Obviously, Aliens is a great movie, even regardless of all that crazy logic there. And also a great movie is the movie Memento. We've talked about Memento several times, starting in episode one. You know, the central conceit is there's this guy who doesn't have any long-term memory. He has only short-term memory because of an accident. And, well, if he had an accident that wiped away his long-term memory, how would he remember that he had an accident and doesn't have any long-term memory? But the film opens more or less with him explaining all about his condition and what happened to him a long time ago, such that he cannot remember anything a long time ago. It's just one of those things where that's the premise of the movie, and you must accept it, and if you do accept it, then, okay, we can take you on a great ride. Premises you'd sometimes have to do that with.
Yeah, I've also got Memento on my list, down one at my number three position. I agree. The plot holes certainly don't sink the movie. I still like all the movies that are on my list. That's sort of the point. But yeah, I've always wondered that. If he can't remember anything after his accident, how does he know his condition? You know, the movie does actually provide one possible explanation for it, which is that his accident may not actually have caused what he thinks it's caused, and there's something more going on than just physical trauma. But it's tricky to tell. But there are actually some other kind of interesting potential issues with Memento. I think it's a movie that's actually got a couple of other small plot holes in it. But yeah, that's kind of the big one, isn't it? But still a great flick anyway. And also a great film is my number four pick, The Big Sleep, which we've talked about before as well, 1946, Howard Hawks, and one of the most famous plot holes in movie history. Allegedly, while Howard Hawks was working on this film, they were working on it, and they realized, look, what's going on here? There's a character who dies, the chauffeur driver who dies at one point in the movie, toward the middle of the story, and how he dies is at first a mystery, and it's a big turning point in the film, as it forces the Humphrey Bogart character to really start investigating. It kind of ups the stakes of everything more and makes the mystery that much more important. But we're never actually clear who it is that kills the chauffeur driver, and allegedly, Hawks and his team wired Raymond Chandler, the author of the novel that the film is based on, and asked, can you please explain to us who killed the limo driver? We can't figure it out from the novel. And Chandler's famous response, quite probably apocryphal but still very funny, was, how the hell should I know? I mean, hey, he'd only written the book. And it's actually a real testament to The Big Sleep, both the novel and the film, that it's still a really compelling mystery, despite the fact that this mystery never, ever satisfactorily explained. You can come to, I think, one or two conclusions about who killed him. Well, at least two. But, yeah, they just seem to sort of lose interest in figuring out who done this particular murder. Bogart wraps up most all the other aspects of the case, but this one just kind of left dangling forever.
Is that really a plot hole? I mean, it's a hole in the literal sense where it's a void, it's a missing piece, but it's not really an inconsistency, which is, I think, what we normally think of when we think of plot holes. I don't know, it's not even a hole for me. I know exactly who killed him. So
sure you do, man. Sure you do.
I do. Well, hey, in my mind, that's what makes sense, and so I've... some movies are audience participation required, and you got to submit your own thoughts.
So the Big Sleep is like a David Lynch film?
No.
It's up to your own interpretation?
I have my own sense of what must have happened, and I don't really buy any other explanation. It's not that I don't know. Anyway, moving on. Number four for me, well, this is more of a plot hole for a book than a movie, but it's about a charmed inanimate object in Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, and the plot hole exists in both the movie and the book. And, well, you don't really notice it because it's sort of a mystery, but by the time you get to the end, you realize, I gotta be careful here so I don't spoil anything, but you realize that the plan of the bad guys, which these bad guys have pursued relentlessly for a year before it comes to fruition, is to go to elaborate and very error-prone lengths to set things up so that Harry will come into contact with an inanimate object, which has been charmed, so it'll do something when he touches it. And, you know, the story works well in spite of this, but if you think about it, gosh, these bad guys, unnamed, could have saved a lot of time and effort by picking any of a thousand other things that Harry could have touched much sooner, much more inconspicuously, and so on. I mean, a doorknob, anything. Enchant something, say, Harry, catch, throw it to him, and call it a day. You can go home.
Yeah, that's a pretty good point. It's right there with all the elaborate death traps in James Bond movies. Why do the villains go through such elaborate... and, of course, one of the best James Bond sort of elaborate death traps that I didn't mention but considered is the part in Goldfinger where Goldfinger reveals his plan to his associates only then to immediately murder them all. Still not sure why he went through all the expense of creating this very, very elaborate diorama and this whole diagram showing exactly what it is he's going to do just to immediately turn around and kill his audience. I guess it's got style, at least. I'll give him that much. Continuing on, number three for me was Memento. I already talked about it, so go ahead again, Sam.
Okay, well, I'm going to do a famous one that I have to imagine you picked, but I'm going to steal it from you. It's Citizen Kane, Rosebud. The whole movie is based on this one reporter finding out what is meant when Charles Foster Kane, at the very beginning of the movie, says the word Rosebud as his dying word. But as far as we can tell, nobody was around when he died to hear him say that. So how would anybody know what his dying word was? And that, of course, drives the rest of the movie.
Right. That is also my number two pick, so good timing with that. Yeah, and I've heard the story told that at one point in time, someone sat down to Orson Welles and said, hey, you know, nobody's in the room with Kane when he dies. You know, the whole point... People have actually, by the way, argued that there is somebody else in the room, but I think that doesn't really work. Sort of, I think Kane has to die alone for the story to really work. That's sort of the point.
Yeah.
He dies by himself. We see a shot then of the door opening and the nurse walking in, finding him dead. Clearly, we're meant to believe he's by himself. You know, we don't see every angle of the room, but come on! He's alone in there. I think just because there could have been somebody else in there doesn't count. The movie never shows us anyone else there. So this is, yeah, a plot hole. And as I was saying, allegedly, when it was told to Welles, when this was pointed out to Welles, he sat there for a little while and then just said, never tell anyone about this, which, if it's not true, it's sort of like the big sleep story. Gosh, I hope it is true.
Okay, well, I stole your number three and your number two. I'm hoping I'm going to steal your number one and finally get you back for that silly remakes thing. But anyway, number two for me, The Letters of Transit in Casablanca. Now, a lot of the plot of Casablanca is tied up with these two characters obtaining letters of transit so they can get out of Casablanca. But, okay, first of all, legal documents signed by whoever it is Peter Lorre says they're signed by, and there is some dispute about who he actually says, but either possibility doesn't work. I mean, the documents signed by whoever he says would not have had much authority at this time in this place. And the other thing is, when they finally do get out of there, nobody ever checks for the documents. So, you know, having the documents apparently didn't matter because nobody cared to check them. So that's my number two plot hole, Casablanca. But a great, great movie, of course.
And my number one pick was also,
excellent,
of course, the Laws of Transit.
Sweet revenge.
Yeah, you know, I love that it works on so many levels. First of all, I'm convinced Lorre says that they're signed by General de Gaulle, which, you know, that would be a famous Frenchman that most Americans would have heard of at the time, so there would be not much explanation more needed. But, of course, General de Gaulle is the head of the exiled French government, not the Vichy French government that is in Morocco at this point in time, so why the heck would the leader of the opposition government possibly be able to sign letters of transit? And then secondly, not only are they not checked at the end of the movie, but the letters are completely disregarded by the Germans, who are refusing to allow the people to board the plane at the end. You know, he's just going to just illegally stop them from leaving. So why such a big deal even being made about the letters of transit at all? I mean, you point out that no one checks for them. No, quite literally, he just doesn't even care whether they have them. They're not going anywhere, regardless of their legal documents. So why does everyone spend so much time arguing about them? And it is a strange thing, because people in the movie make comments like, oh, well, you know, the law here is kind of flexible in Casablanca. That's sort of a central theme. So why does everyone believe it? Why, for that matter, is Victor Laszlo, this resistance leader, not immediately seized by the Nazis? Clearly, the French government in Casablanca is the pawn of the German government, and well, why would they care particularly about any alleged neutrality or any authority here for Laszlo? Yeah, but it's a great movie. Allegedly, Michael Curtiz's response to all this, the director of Casablanca, was just, I'll go so fast, nobody will notice, and I believe that because it moves along at a great clip, and unless you really stop and dissect it, you know, the first time I watched it, I didn't question any of it too much, and it's not until later viewings that it's even been a nagging thing, but I just, in a way, I think it makes the movie more fun, not less.
Yeah. And it's funny how things like that do happen sometimes. If something is a little rough around the edges, in some way that comes across as a bit more genuine to us on occasion. Anyway, well, what could be greater than Citizen Kane or Casablanca that could supplant them both for my number one spot? That would be, of course, Sinbad of the Seven Seas. Now, Stephen, I know you won't believe this, but I found a plot hole in this.
Wait, in Sinbad?
Yeah, yeah.
No.
Yeah, I'll tell you what it is.
One of the tightest scripts. Okay, let's hear it.
Well, it's searching for Princess Alina. Now, huge plot hole. It doesn't matter, though, because the movie is so wonderful that you just don't think about things like this. I mean, I bet if you've seen this movie, this little plot hole has never even occurred to you, but here it is. Okay. When Sinbad the Sailor and his friends go searching for the four gems of Basra, this guy called the Oracle tells them where all the gems are, so they go out looking for them. Well, partway into their search, suddenly they're talking about trying to find not the gems, but Princess Alina, who's been captured and spirited away by the evil Jafar, the wizard of all that is evil. You know him, don't you? But see, here's the thing. Poochie the Dwarf, Sinbad's loyal little companion, had previously spied on Jafar and saw that the Princess Alina, princess of all that is good, was being kept in his tower of the castle back home, and he told everybody else, so they all know where the Princess Alina is. And that's now what they're out there searching the oceans for anyway, but for this one moment, all the characters seem to forget what they're doing and wonder where Alina is. It's funny, you know, so obvious and glaring in hindsight, but when you're watching a movie, it's just it just wraps you up in it, you're so caught up in it, you just miss little details like that. So I like that plot hole.
I think
my number one.
I think probably what happened was Jafar cast a spell of confusion on the party, so they forgot about it. I just can't believe that such a well-structured, so greatly written script like Sinbad of the Seven Seas could contain such an obvious plot hole. I think it's probably us as the viewers missing a subtle clue.
You can say the same thing about The Big Sleep, can't you?
I'm going to have to go back and watch Sinbad frame by frame and see if I can figure it out.
Sure. All right, well, let's recap. I guess it's you first.
All right, me first. Let's go. So, my top six plot holes in otherwise good movies. Number six, The Rock, 1996, Michael Bay directing. Number five, James Cameron's 1986 film, Aliens. Number four, the noir classic by Howard Hawks, The Big Sleep from 1946. Number three, Memento from 2001 by Christopher Nolan. Number two, Citizen Kane, Orson Welles' debut in 1941. And number one, Casablanca, 1940, directed by Michael Curtiz.
And my number six, driving trucks over landmines and die another day, remembering what you're not supposed to remember in Memento, charming a logistically difficult inanimate object in Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire for my number four. Number three, saying Rosebud and nobody around to hear it in Citizen Kane. Number two, the Letters of Transit in Casablanca. And number one, searching for the Princess Alina, even though you already know where she is, in the great classic Sinbad of the Seven Seas.
One of the most basic things we never even really stop and think about when we watch movies is how they're edited. You know, we talk a lot about shot composition, that's kind of obvious, the way films look, but editing, if it's done well, is something we tend not to notice because we just sort of subconsciously take it in. In fact, that we take this in subconsciously is something that filmmakers absolutely count on. But it wasn't always this way. So we're going to take a look back in the next 2 weeks at the history of film editing. It's a complicated subject, and we're going to move a little fast and gloss through some stuff. But I think that's okay because we don't want to spend an entire 16-week college course on the history of editing, though we easily could if we wanted to. So, anyway, we get started back the very, very early days of film with the very first silent shorts. Now, obviously, the real, real first silent shorts consisted of a single shot. You know, when you have your movie consist of a guy sneezing, as one of the very famous early Edison shorts did, you don't need to edit anything because there's only one shot. Likewise, the early Lumiere brothers travelogues or single shot, you know, short films, no editing needed. But really quickly, by the very early 1900s, people started developing more narrative films, films that told a story, and that had multiple scenes in the film. And so this requires you have to put those scenes together. And, you know, obviously the way you did it was you'd film a section, then you'd turn off the camera and go do another setup, and you'd film your next scene. And then to edit it together, you just physically cut film and taped it or glued it or whatever back together. Got a way to get your film back together. So that's essentially what editing at its core is. Important to recognize that it actually, really in the old days, like we've mentioned before, really, really truly involved physically cutting and reattaching film together. But the very early silent narrative films didn't have a whole lot of editing. That's because they really took their cues from the theater. There are multiple scenes in a play, for instance, but there's no editing, obviously. There's nothing to edit. It's all live. So you'll have a scene, then everything stops. The curtain goes down for a little bit. They change out the stuff, comes back up, and you have your next scene. And the early shorts kind of look a lot like this. You have every scene is a single shot, and then you go to the next scene, and that's another shot. So there, again, not a whole lot of editing. But we started seeing some editing going on, some interesting ideas in editing, sort of starting around 1902, 1903. And one of the first guys to really start doing this was the American director Edwin S. Porter, who's really famous for his 1903 film, The Great Train Robbery. He made another film right before that that also is considered a real landmark in editing. But what's really important about Porter's work is that they contain edits that leap around in time. Prior to this, movies really focused on very sort of chronological thing, much like plays tend to be more chronological. Well, Porter realized, I can jump backwards, 5 minutes, and the audience will figure it out. So he's going to really rely on the idea that audiences can make connections that are not explicit. One of his earlier films actually featured a... there's this idea of a dream sequence. He didn't actually cut away for a dream sequence. He superimposed a dream sequence. So you see a guy sleeping in bed, and then superimposed above him is his dreams. It's one of the very first attempts at a movie to sort of show the thoughts of a character, something that also would be kind of difficult to do in a play, for instance, but the kinds of things are very common in other forms of storytelling. Novels have all sorts of crazy chronological stuff well before this time. But in the movies, it's not clear whether you could do this or not. Well, at almost exactly the same time that Porter is messing around with his early films, a couple of British directors are doing some more experimenting right around 1901, 1902, 1903. You get things like some of the first point of view shots, which require editing to make it clear whose point of view we have, for instance. Use of editing for emotional impact as well, not just moving the story forward, but we can edit and go to one thing or another. And there's a film from 1904 by the British director Cecil Hepworth called Rescued by Rover, and it's the exciting story of a dog rescuing a baby that's been stolen by gypsies, which, I kid you not, this was a huge international success in 1904. They actually had to remake it because the original negative got worn out. doesn't seem like anyone today would be interested in watching a several-minute film about a dog that rescues a baby after the gypsies steal it, but there you go. And it's actually a very important film in the history of movies, because we have this first part where the gypsy steals the baby, and then the dog we watch, and it's a dog movie. We watch the dog in a series of shots go find the baby. He's got to run out the window and then go through the forest and then swim through the river or whatever, and then the dog finds, and it's a bunch of real short cuts. Each scene is not very long, or in fact they're not really even scenes, it's one sequence, almost kind of like we think of maybe a montage or something today. So the dog finds the baby, then he runs back, and we watch the dog retrace his steps using the same camera setups as before. And so the dog comes back in, he finds the master, and now Hepworth does something really interesting. He cuts right now just to go back and show us the master of the dog rescuing the baby. We don't actually have to watch the master retrace all the steps. This is called elliptical editing. We've cut something out of the storyline. So that's actually a pretty interesting advancement, this thing that, yeah, you really can leap around in time. You can really cut forward. The audience goes ahead and subconsciously puts that into place. We know that they walked through those sequence of steps again. The dog led the master. We've seen it twice. We don't need to see it again. So this is another pretty big development. So we get these small starts and move forwards until we come to one of the most important filmmakers in history, a guy named D.W. Griffith, an American filmmaker who just completely and totally revolutionized film. It's really hard to overstate how important Griffith is to early film. It's strange because it's one of those things where sometimes people like to, I think, bash Griffith. There's reasons to do it, but he didn't exactly invent most of the techniques that he used. He's going to become really famous for some of his editing techniques. You can always find them in earlier films, just about. The important thing with Griffith is the way he combined them, the way he seemed so intuitive. Like, this is just a guy who seemed to understand the way that we could combine all these sort of disparate editing techniques to make a single kind of what we'd call today a grammar or a language of film. So, very telling that Griffith's first movie is called The Adventures of Dolly, about a baby who gets stolen by gypsies. Yes, that's right. Griffith's first movie was a ripoff of Rescued by Rover. So even in 1908, the studios were even then just completely and totally stealing ideas from one another.
That's too bad that somebody already stole the idea of stealing that story, because I was thinking, you know, hey, I can make a student film for that.
Yeah.
That would be really good.
There are lots and lots of people who stole Rescued by a Rover. That's It was a simpler time then when we wanted to see stories about dogs rescuing babies. Anyway, but it's telling. Griffith's first movie is, sort of a ripoff of this really influential film. And again, we see a lot of these same editing techniques get employed. But really quickly, Griffith comes to realize in his shorts that you can really shape a story via editing. You don't have to just rely on the script to do these sorts of things. The editing of a film is just as important as anything else in terms of telling the story. One of his most famous shorts is a 1909 short called A Corner in Wheat, which is about wheat farmers and the way they're being exploited by the upper class. And there's a really, really famous scene where Griffith's going to do what's called cross-cutting, where you cut between two things more than once. You cut from one scene to another, then back to the first scene, which is a really interesting kind of thing that only really happens in movies. You can't do that in a play very easily at all. So in A Corner in Wheat, we get this really famous scene where he's cutting between this banquet where all the fat cats are and they're living it up, and cutting to the soup kitchen poverty line where the poor farmhands are getting some stale bread passed out to them, and we're cutting back and forth between it. I mean, here he is in 1909, cutting for this real sense of emotional resonance to contrast two ideas. And it's going to be in The Birth of a Nation, Griffith's first feature, and again, one of those things, Birth of a Nation, not technically the first feature film, but it's the first feature film that's a massive hit, and it's going to make long-form narrative films to be, like, commercially the norm and be commercially acceptable. This really invented sort of the modern film, The Birth of a Nation, and I don't really want to get into it too much. There's a lot to talk about. In case you don't know, it's a movie in which the Ku Klux Klan is the heroes, and a very racist movie in a lot of ways. Very problematic. It's one of those things that everyone has trouble discussing today, but nonetheless, in terms of technical style alone, an absolute masterpiece. Griffith uses close-ups, for instance, and close-ups aren't something that are going to be used a whole lot. Again, there are people who had tried close-ups before Griffith, but he uses them to great effect to make things emotional. And actually, one interesting thing worth mentioning is that the close-up requires editing to work. You can't just suddenly have a close-up of an object or a face if you haven't already established whose face that belongs to. And if you want to say you want to, you know, show an emotion on a person's face, well, you show that person talking or doing whatever, we get a sense of who that person is, and then you have to cut into that person's face. Well, the editing is important because we have to make that transition. The audience can't think, what? What's going on? What's this giant face I'm looking at right now? Or it won't work. So you have to, you know, obviously, in addition to actually filming a face close up, the editing has to be smooth and work. And, you know, it was probably not obvious when people first started making films that you could do that and that audiences would accept it. But you really see a modern sense of editing when you watch Birth of a Nation. The shot, rather than the scene, is clearly the central unit of film here. We're not just stuck with individual scenes. We'll have a scene with lots and lots of shots in it. And this is just really, really important, and Griffith just edited them brilliantly well together. I mean, and it's interesting because, of course, even though there's all these other movies out there, you know, this is before real sort of film scholarship existed. Griffith does this because Griffith just understands it on some basic level, I think. He was a connoisseur of other movies, he'd seen other movies, but it's not like he's got textbooks and textbooks to rely upon here. He hasn't done studies that show the effects of this on audiences. He's just doing it sort of from a gut level.
You know, it's tough to look back at Birth of a Nation or Intolerance, which you made after that, and recognize all these things that you're saying. I think it really will drive home if you watch that, but also watch in conjunction some other movie from preferably before 1915. In fact, when we talked about animation earlier, go watch Gertie the Dinosaur, which is, you know, you can see it online on the web somewhere. There's a live-action portions of it in the beginning and the end, and you can just look at that and see how strange it is for not looking and feeling like a movie. It's like somebody just plunked a camera down in front of a bunch of people acting, and they acted in front of it. And that's, in fact, what they did. There's no editing to show close-ups, to show facial reactions, for comic timing, none of that stuff. And it feels weird when you look at that to not see those things. We're so used to film grammar, as they call it. But, you know, so if you don't understand what Birth of a Nation did, watch something before that, and then it'll really drive home the point here.
Yeah, there's a real sense that earlier movies are static, whereas Griffith's films are very, very dynamic. And you know, the thing is, it's not like everyone else immediately picked up on it either. You watch movies that are made even around or after Birth of a Nation, other American films, and they feel very static. It really does take the rest of the world about a decade to kind of catch up to where Griffith was in the 1910s. It's very, very impressive. Yeah, I mean, Birth of a Nation is a movie everyone has to watch if they're interested in the history of film, and I'll let you come to your own conclusions about the other aspects of it. But just from a technical, stylistic standpoint, it's very, very effective. Also very famously used cross-cutting several times in the movie, a couple battle scenes, but also really, really in the climax of the film that has the Ku Klux Klan riding to the rescue to save the... here I go again, trying to describe the movie, to save the besieged people on the farm from marauding black people. That just sounds so terrible. But anyway, you talk about a movie that's able to cut between these guys riding to the rescue, cut back to the people in the farmhouse getting besieged. Almost, you know, it feels like if you've ever seen a Western movie where the cavalry are rushing in, this is where it comes from. You watch pretty much any movie where people are going to rescue other people and you want to build tension by conflict cutting back to the people who are in danger. Well, this is how you do it, and Griffith is doing it right here. Well, his later films as well are also very important, and arguably his next film, Intolerance, which he kind of made as a defense to charges of racism for Birth of a Nation, it, in a sense just as important as editing, not nearly as commercially successful, but Intolerance takes four stories that are just completely separated by time. Like, you know, one's in ancient Judea, one's in, like, 16th century Europe, all these different stories, and cuts between them. It's not one story, and then the second, and then the third, and then the fourth. All four happen at the same time, and, you know, there's not a linking thread besides themes. Themes link them together, and we're going to cut between them. It's very much like something you'd see in a sophisticated novel, and to see this again in the 1910s in American film is amazing. And so nobody had ever done something like that. I don't think anyone ever made a big-budget epic movie like that, as different stories, as completely disparate, and cut together the same way as an Intolerance. Really, really revolutionary that Griffith would think to do that, think that would make sense. Because the obvious way, if you're going to tell these four stories, would be to tell them one after the other, right? It'd be confusing otherwise. Well, Griffith is able to make it all clear and make it work, cutting them all together like that. You know, not many movies do that, period. It's a difficult thing to do. Well, one of the reasons that Intolerance is so important, despite it not being a huge commercial success on the order of Birth of a Nation, is because it falls into the hands of Soviet filmmakers after World War I. And sort of the next big development in editing is going to be what's called Soviet montage, which is a strange thing. We think of a French word like montage being associated with the Soviet Union. But after World War I, the Russian Revolution kind of continued on. I mean, the Russian Revolution was really this long, extended civil war. And so there was this period of time where these two armies are fighting for control of Russia, or the Soviet Union, after World War I, and it led to a real shortage of film. So if there's a real shortage of fresh film stock, obviously what you're going to be making is newsreels rather than fictional films. And in newsreels, editing is really, really important because you're obviously, you know, you don't want to show everything. You don't have scripts in advance. You have footage. You got to put it together. And so one of the guys who was sort of heading one of the major newsreels companies was this guy named, I'm going to try and pronounce that, I know no Russian. His name is Lev Kuleshov. He supervised one of these major film reel companies and sort of emerged in the late 1910s, early 1920s, while the Russian Civil War was raging, was this what was sometimes called the Kuleshov Workshop. A bunch of Russian filmmakers just sort of playing around with editing because they couldn't go out and shoot new films. And one of the things they did is they had Intolerance, which actually is a film that Lenin purportedly loved. And so it was an important film for Soviets, and they loved this film, Intolerance. These filmmakers watch it over and over and over, and they even tried experimented cutting it up and seeing, how does it look if we change this sequence of shots? And it's kind of one of those interesting things where, you know, out of not having enough supplies to make their own movies, they just studied the heck out of editing. One of the things that they did was they actually did what somebody like Griffith wouldn't have done, and they did studies. Very famously, they did a couple of different studies, like you film an actor looking blankly, a real short close-up of a guy, and then you cut to a different thing. So you have him staring blankly, and then you cut to some food, or you cut to a beautiful woman or something. And you show it to audiences, but you only show them one set. So audience A gets guy staring blankly and then cuts to food. Audience B gets guy staring blankly, cuts to a beautiful woman. Then you ask audience A, what expression does the actor have on his face? And they say, he's hungry. You get audience B, and you say, his expression is, he's in lust. He's expressing love or lust. Well, they got the exact same shot. The shot after it actually influenced what the audience thought the actor was doing. And they came to realize exactly how powerful editing could be, and they sort of created a formal theory of editing. They did other experiments, too, really showing how you could cut to get different reactions. They started really sort of formalizing this, saying, you can cut, let's say you have an image moving left to right, so you have someone running across the frame going left to right. Well, if you cut to another image that continues to move from left to right, it can be a completely different image, it can be the same person, we get a sense of continuity. But if you cut to an image going right to left now, we have this real sense of conflict. It's just this weird sort of subconscious way that our brains seem to process images, that just the way they appear in sequence is vital to our feelings about them. So this whole theory of editing, they called montage, which is the French word for editing. And the most prominent of these filmmakers was a guy named Sergei Eisenstein. In the early 1920s, they started to get access to cameras and film again, and so a bunch of the students, these guys who had been playing around with editing and studying it, started to make their own films. And in 1925, Eisenstein made Battleship Potemkin, probably one of the most influential movies ever made. It's a silent film that's about one of the touchstones of the Russian Revolution. These sailors on a czarist ship that revolted and overthrew it. So many interesting things in this movie. It feels so fresh. There are scenes in it where Eisenstein has shots that are as short as a quarter of a second long. I mean, that's just a couple of frames of film that he's building. We could have like a 6-second action, right, that may be composed of 15 different shots. And the amount of work it takes to get that, I've got to film it all the different setups, is incredible. And then to put it together, imagine how difficult it would be to put together all these film pieces and make a coherent image that we can process. If you watch a lot of movies today, and we'll talk about this in the next segment, but if you watch movies today that are hyper-edited, this really fast editing style, a lot of times you have no idea what the heck is going on. Well, Potemkin has these really, really short cuts, and yet it's always clear what's going on. The most famous sequence is the battle on the Odessa steppes, and there's so many famous moments from this, but he's got a whole bunch of different shots that make up this battle. He's got long, wide shots that let us see everything that's happening at once. He's got traveling shots that are following the action one direction or another. He's got close-ups of faces. He's got real quick shots of action or of people fighting, this kind of thing, and he builds them all into today what we would think of as just an action sequence. But if you look at earlier action movies, and there aren't really a lot of true action movies, but like earlier movies that deal with war and that kind of thing, they're much more slowly edited. We don't have nearly as many shots to make up a single scene, and here Eisenstein just does it wonderfully. And there's also other stuff in Potemkin that is really interesting today. When we think of montage, a sort of like series of actions showing something set to music, that kind of thing, well, Potemkin absolutely has those kinds of things as well. You know, we'll show the sailors cleaning the ship or something. We'll see just a bunch of different people doing their jobs very quickly, cutting between them. We can show progress, that kind of thing. All of that is in Potemkin. And then Eisenstein went on to make other films that are also just considered real classics. But it's really Potemkin that kind of, along with Birth of a Nation and Intolerance, really sets the foundation for modern editing techniques. And Potemkin, you know, it's made by a Soviet filmmaker, but it gets seen all over the world, and it's just really going to influence all future filmmakers. So we'll talk a bit about the influence and the effect of sort of the Soviet montage and all this stuff on maybe some filmmakers around the world, classical Hollywood, and we'll talk about how it all leads up to modern editing techniques that we see today.
It's the end of the show. Time to talk about Batman. It was the first movie to feature more than one actor who had ever played Batman. It might be the only one, and it's quite recent. Do you have a guess, Steven?
Not off the top of my head.
1998.
Out of Sight.
Elmore Leonard. Yeah, very good. Out of Sight, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Michael Keaton's in that. I forgot.
Yep. Michael Keaton is in it as a small part. George Clooney is, of course, the lead. Keaton, interestingly, plays the same character he played
in the
previous year's film, Jackie Brown. Right. And both of these movies were, of course, based on Elmore Leonard novels. So a neat little bit of trivia there. I'm not sure if there's been any movies since that had more than one Batman in it, but certainly by 1998, that was the first one. I'll imagine that. The butler did it all along. Well, I guess this episode's over, so we'll move along to our preview of the next episode. Actually, first, though, you should check out our website, allmovietalk.com. It's spelled all movie talk, and then a period, and then a com on the end. And if you put that into browser, you can go to our website, which has all kinds of movie-related content that just never makes it on the show. And you can also check out rankworks.com, RANKworks.com, for a number of entertainment features, including some relating to movies. What do we got next week?
Next week we have a top six list.
Really?
We sure do. I know, it's totally unexpected, huh? That's another twist ending for you, folks. A top six list about directorial swan songs, the final movies by directors. So our top six movies that were the last films by their directors, if you can wrap your head around that. I think we're also going to talk about the Tarzan movie series, which I am so excited about because I love Tarzan. That, and of course, part two of History of Editing up next week.
Shaving a haircut, two bits.